Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Jan Reynolds just wanted to be one of the guys. Growing up as one of seven children on a dairy farm in Middlebury, Reynolds was accustomed to hard work and thought nothing of a tough physical challenge. This propelled her to record-setting high-altitude adventures in the company of some of the world's top mountaineers, often as the only woman on expeditions on the highest summits. Reynolds set the world high-altitude skiing record for women when she skied off the summit of 24,757-foot Mustang-Ada Peak in the Pamirs in western China. She soared and crashed in a hot air balloon at 29,000 feet over Everest and led the first U.S. women's biathlon team. Esquire named her the Athlete of the Decade in the 1980s, Ultrasport dubbed her Indiana Jan, and she appeared everywhere from the cover of Outside Magazine to the Today Show to National Geographic. Reynolds chronicles her adventures in her book, The Glass Summit, One Woman's Epic Journey Breaking Through. No longer wanting to be one of the boys, she writes about the power and importance of women throughout the world. Reynolds, who is now 68, has also written and photographed over 20 books documenting vanishing cultures around the world. Jan Reynolds was inducted into the U.S. Ski Hall of Fame in 2021 and into the Vermont Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame in 2008. Earlier this winter, I skied with Jan at Trapp Family Lodge in Stowe, where she still teaches cross-country ski lessons. She showed me a trailside bench with a plaque that honors her and her two sons, and led me on a wild high-speed adventure on and off groomed trails through her favorite mountains. I caught up with Jan at her home in Stowe in the shadow of Vermont's highest peak. Jan Reynolds, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Great to be here and see you, David.
I want to begin where you begin your book because it's such a great introduction to you. You begin The Glass Summit, One Woman's Epic Journey Breaking Through, by writing, "I climbed at high altitude in the death zone and set world skiing records. I consistently shot five bullets within the size of my thumbnail at 50 meters. I skydived, scuba dived, and more, always in the company of men. I was one of the guys until I was almost 40. So let's just start there. Now you're 68.
This month.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, dear.
You were one of the guys. Why did you want to be one of the guys? You are known as a crusading woman explorer, but you were always wanting to be, why be one of the guys?
I never wanted to be one of the guys. I never aimed to be one of the guys. I always felt very female. And I don't know if you see me that way now. I consider myself very female. And what I brought to all these trips or times I spent with men would be, I think, a feminine or female point of view. It's just that that's who was doing what I was doing at the level I liked doing it at. That's where the guy, they were guys. Now there are many women doing those things. It's just that I didn't let anything outside in the society or in my family or in the culture tell me what I was supposed to do or be. So I would just do and be what I wanted. And there ended up being all guys there. It just was happenstance. But if you do look at today, now young women, and that's the idea of the glass summit, trying to break through. I wasn't trying to do that either. I was just doing the fun stuff, going hard and fast and fun. And now it's typically what women do now, all women. You have a daughter. She does everything, right?
She didn't set the high-altitude women's skiing record.
Well, but you know what? I didn't go there to set the record. Here's what happened. National Geographic couldn't get their correspondence that far west in China at the time. And I had gone over with the editor of Ski Magazine, and he was the first person let in to see what there was for skiing in China. It had been closed for 48 years, so nearly 50 years. communist China was shut down. And for young people, that probably seems strange to think about China now, but I'm just old enough that when I went to Beijing, it was pretty much all bicycles, no cars. People didn't have cars. And when we were there, we were loaded with skis from all the ski companies that were curious about what there was for skiing in China. Wouldn't you like that market? So the editor of Ski Magazine took me and my climbing partner, Ned Gillette, over because he needed a story once he was let in. He had a Chinese friend, and that was all part of the deal that got him into China at that time. So Ned and I were the coaches for young, what would be called junior champions, so we could start teaching them what they needed to do to train for skiing. And when we got there, they had skis that were made of one plank of wood, and we went to where they made them and curved the tips, this hickory wood. And so because we'd gone and done that, and I'm sure whatever their equivalent of the CIA is had thoroughly checked us out, the Chinese Mountaineering Association, because everything is government-run, said to us, you know, we like you, what can we do for you? And we said, oh, we want to climb and ski something. We didn't know what the hell we wanted, but we hopped on it. And I give Ned the credit, too, and we did a little bit of research, and we found this peak that hadn't been done. I think the Chinese had done it in training for Everest, and it looked like we could ski it, so we got permission to climb and ski Mustagata on the far western border of China, where 55 different minorities live. Some can grow hair on their face, some can't, just to give you an idea of what it all looked like. And Beijing at that time hadn't even strung communication out that far. Into an area, there was a town village called Kashgar, which is, you know, all built up now. So they gave us permission to do a peak that they didn't even have phone contact with.
Wow. So this is Mustagata. It
Mustagata.
Was a 24,000 foot peak?
25. So a long story here, but what actually happened was we were bumped ahead of all the most famous mountaineers in the world, Reinhold Messner. Okay, if you know him,
legendary Austrian mountaineer.
Yeah, you might want to describe him. He climbed all the 8,000 meter peaks before anyone else in the world. We were bumped ahead of him, everyone, because they knew us. We were checked out. We gave them skis. We coached their kids. So National Geographic glommed onto that expedition because they couldn't get correspondence into China, let alone to cross it to the western border. So we're in Xinjiang, which we've heard more about what's going on with the Uyghurs there.
Yes.
The Xinjiang province sits north of Tibet. So there's been so much controversy and suffering in Xinjiang and Tibet. We know a lot about Tibet because of the Dalai Lama. We hear less about the Uyghurs in Xinjiang because they don't have that kind of public exposure. But we saw this long ago, but that's a whole nother story. So at any rate, we go in, we climb, we ski Mustagata. And two of the guys and I make the summit. We go from about...
It had been climbed before?
It had been climbed before by the Chinese who wanted to test out some climbers for high altitude to see if they would put them on an Everest trip because Everest hadn't been climbed on the north side, which is the Tibet side yet. Mm. And the Chinese wanted to be the first to do that. So the really interesting thing is I got to be part of and meet and know our liaison officer was the guy who actually made the summit of Everest from the Tibet side first ever. He had no toes. We loved him, Lao Chu. But that's so many stories. I want to go back to finish when you said, well, you know, your daughter didn't set the high altitude skiing record. Well, I was just climbing and skiing with the guys, doing what I loved, and came down, we made it, we came back, and it was weeks later, National Geographic calls me and said, hey, you set the women's high altitude skiing record, and you men, no one has skied the guy that fell down Everest. Remember, he fell right away?
Yes, there was a movie called The Man Who Skied Everest,
but he fell.
Skiers know it as The Man Who Fell Down Everest.
Well, what happened is no one had skied from a summit that high yet. He had gone a little higher than us. but he hadn't gone from a summit. So the guys set that Geographic likes records.
Yeah.
So my point of that whole long-winded story is, so I set the record, but I was totally clueless. I was not doing it.
You were just
to set a record. I was going like, whoa, we get to climb and ski this peak and I get to go. I'm psyched. Let's do it.
So let me ask, your book, which is now titled The Glass Summit, a previous edition was titled High Altitude Woman. And high altitudes, the places you're climbing are known as the death zone. What is it like to be and to try and actually do aerobic activities like skiing at 25,000 feet?
Well, you know, and I should clarify, that's just on the edge of what they call the death zone, but I've never used oxygen on any peaks. We just climbed in a very clean, fast, quick style. And we went from 20,000 feet to 25,000 feet and back down in one day. And that's only because the two guys I climbed with, they held the record. And I don't know if it's been beaten. They climbed and skied Denali in a day. In a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fast.
So they go fast. There's safety in that because you're not, you know, you're not on the mountain longer, but you better have the skills and the ability or you could die trying. So what's it like up there? When you're climbing, you get into a rhythm, and so you match your breathing with the pace. And what was so shocking to me is when we reach the summit, we're locking down our bindings, we check each other's bindings, because at 25,000 feet, your muscles and your brain are getting 50% of the oxygen they get at sea level. So you know you're half nuts. And so we're checking each other, and I take off, and I do about, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 turns, and all of a sudden I stop, and I leaned over my poles, and I have never hoovered, sucked in air as hard and fast as then, because I learned you're not going at a pace, you're not monitoring your oxygen intake, you just take off, and then all of a sudden you're without air. I mean, I could have just fallen over and passed out, but then I would have eventually started breathing. So then I really had to pay attention to how I did my turns and how many at once. And I bet you've been somewhere hairball or something when you've been skiing and or it's hard in the snow and you do a few turns and you stop and you're like, right?
Yes.
So at altitude,
like a fish thrown on a dock.
Oh man, there you go. That's what it's like. A fish thrown on the dock. So you've got to get a rhythm. You've got to get a pace. You got to figure it out. Even when you're going down, it's all about pacing.
So you're keeping up with men, but you know it's generally understood men are faster, have bigger lung capacity, bigger muscles, musculature. There are some differences. So keeping up can be really hard, if not impossible, at a certain point. And you just mentioned that one of the guys had set speed records on Denali. So even among men, these guys are kind of at the limits of what the male human body can do. But you're doing it in a women's body.
Yeah, and I could best them lots of times. And so a lot of it is, if you look at a marathon, it's not quite long enough for a woman to beat a man. But when the events go longer, women have a better enduring capacity. We have a subcutaneous fat layer, which is probably a survival thing for nursing and having babies and whatnot. And I've been on expeditions where the guys are bonking. And if you know what I mean by bonking, the blood sugar gets so low, they just kind of are done. And I always seem to have a little bit more. So when we ran out of food for 5 days on the Everest Circle expedition and we were just looking for caves and rocks to sleep under at night, and we ran out of food and we rejoiced when somebody found a bouillon cube in one pocket and we divided it 3 ways with water, I was the one that would go out and get snow or icicles and make the fire to melt snow for water. I had more gas. So we're just different. If you want power, like Steve McKinney, when we had to, he held the men's world speed skiing record. So to hold a tuck at, I don't know what, over 200 kilometers an hour, you have to be incredibly strong. And we had to haul bags up another peak that was very technical called Pumori, which we climbed in the winter. I think it was the first winter ascent ever done in the Himalaya. And you want Steve when you need that power, but Steve was crashed when I was still going. I had the endurance that he didn't have. So that's what I meant by besting people. And I think that's a good example. His power was beyond mine, but my endurance was beyond his. And I think he would say the same.
Running out of food on an expedition around Everest is a huge miscalculation and is life-threatening. What happened and how did you get through that?
Well, you know, this is the other thing. If I had made the mistake, it would be, oh, you should never take a woman on an expedition. She doesn't get it right. She messed it up. But actually, Ned and I co-led the expedition. And I was in charge of the team and team selection. I was in charge of food, goods, equipment. And he would take care of the politics and permission. And he had the paperwork and he had the maps. And he forgot the map.
Wow.
Well, we had something like 32 barrels. You know, we had a long yak train. I knew what was in every barrel. I had it listed. One yak didn't make it. I knew everything that was in the barrel that was on the yak's back and how, what I needed to procure so the expedition would still go on, and which I did, which is all good. It's not like, you know, ooh, I'm great. That was just my job. Ned did an amazing job of working with the politics and the permissions and the money. And he liked the sponsor work and, you know, the money and the power, quite frankly, even though it would go to the men, it didn't interest me as much. I'm much more interested in the team and who's there and how they're doing and what equipment do we have and how is it working and supplies. So what happened was, without the map, we went off route and we had enough food. If we'd stayed on route, did my part, but we ran out of food. So what do? You got to keep going till you find civilization. And, you know, so that was a mistake, but, you know, we made it through. And my climbing buddy, Jim Bridwell, said, adventure is, let me see if I can remember this. Adventure is where you wish you were when you aren't, and where you aren't where you when you wish you were. Did that make sense?
It does.
I say it right? Adventure is where you wish you weren't when you are, and you wish you were when you aren't. You know? An adventure is usually when something gets messed up.
Well,
the unknown, right?
We've referenced Ned Gillette a number of times, so I think it would be helpful to just explain. Ned was your partner in love and life.
He was my climbing partner, and we lived together for about 10 years here in Stowe. But eventually, he just never wanted children and never had them. So I moved on, and I did.
Was it complicated to be on these intense expeditions with your partner in life?
Not really. We had a relationship where we appreciated each other's skills and differences. He was doing a lot of the things that I'd rather not, which I probably could have, which eventually I did when I did trips on my own. And we skied a 23,000-foot peak on skating skis, Mira. We made skinny skins, and then we took double overboots and adjustable crampons for the top. But that's another story. So, yes, I could do...
That sounds terrifying.
That's in there in the book. I guess you haven't gotten there yet. I'm pretty sure Mira's in there. Anyhow, I forget what's in each book. So, and that was another record. And I don't think... Light is right. It took the British 3 days what we did in one bivvy, up and down.
Wow.
So, you know, I've led expeditions after Ned and I separated, but they were always smaller, just two or three people. And so I could do the power, the paper, the politics, the sponsors. But I preferred to be involved in the gear and the team, the gear and the guys, making sure everything's copacetic.
Well, let me ask you move on in your life. You and Ned are no longer partners in adventures and in life. You marry the father of your children, and you have your first child, and you describe that in the minds of the people you adventured with, it was almost as if I had died.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You had a kid. I wasn't getting the phone calls. Nobody was saying, hey, when are we riding, our bikes, or let's get a ski in. It's almost like, all I did was have a baby. I'm still here. Yet, that did not happen to my husband at the time. He would still get just as many calls. And I'm like, what? Wait. What happened to me? What am I, a chopped liver?
So what did happen? What happens in the mind of the people you used to have fun with once you become a mom?
I think they put me in a different category. I think they just made assumptions. But the good thing about that was it just pushed me to find women to have fun with. And, they may not have wanted to do what I wanted at the level I wanted, but we still were out there doing it. And so I met them when I was with the kids at the playgrounds and this and that. And I really came to appreciate women's skills and early women in businesses, in law, politics. And we would talk about what it was like to have our kids and be working too. So for young women now, they probably wouldn't understand it because they have so much more opportunity. But having a cache of women that I could hang out with, and, like your wife, who's done a lot, it was just great for me to spend more time with women, really understand their skills and appreciate them and champion them and see that women could do a lot more than men could. We have babies and we do all these other things. I mean, when you think about that, every single environment, when I lived with an indigenous tribe on each continent and wrote about them and photographed them for my book series, Vanishing Cultures. And when you think about it, all the women in the Amazon territory survive and do everything men do, right? So why do we think a woman can't live in a triple canopy jungle or high altitude? The Sherpas and Tibetan women are there. Or, for example, the Inuit, they have babies in igloos. I mean, think about that. They do everything men do in a frozen environment, and they have babies. So I'm not trying to sound like totally feminist or radical. I'm just being practical. Let's look at what women have done always in our human family. If you look back in time, of course we can do everything men do. We just have different skills and different approaches. Men have that power and strength in their muscles, but we're more enduring.
You spent a big part of your early years, as you write, trying to be more of a guy than the guys. But then you describe you had this epiphany during a solo Himalayan expedition, and you were sick and alone and taken in by Tibetan herders. And that opened your eyes to a different way of being. Talk about what happened to you on that trip.
Well, I'm not sure, this will be interesting, I'm not sure what type of being you're aiming towards, but when I was really very sick, I typically, I'm forever throwing myself into these things, assuming I'm going to swim. Like if someone else did it, I can do it kind of thing. And because I had climbed difficult peaks and had been at higher altitudes, I thought, 20,000 foot pass and there's going to be herders and yaks, people, food. I can do that by myself. I'm going to go. And I was working for National Geographic again. And they sent me over. They covered all the costs to cover this ancient salt trade over a 20,000 foot pass, the Nong Pala, before the Chinese shut it down. And that's how Sherpas came to be. Sher means east, Pa means people. So Sherpas are Tibetans. Really, that just live on the other side of the Himalaya from Tibet. So I probably, now that we've had COVID, I probably caught some kind of Asian flu or bird flu or something and I'm up close to the height of the pass. I'm on my own. Horrible storms are happening, so no yaks and herders are coming across. I can't get out of my tent. I'm having trouble breathing, but because of being a internationally competitive biathlete, because I was on the U.S. biathlon team, I had learned how to control my breathing when shooting. So I learned how to control my breathing around all the phlegm to very slowly pull in enough oxygen so I didn't just faint or whatever. But I had to stay kind of perfectly still and not move a lot and use a lot of oxygen. And then I'd hack up some of that stuff and breathing would be a little easier, but I could barely even crawl out of my tent to scoop snow, to melt snow for water. No water, you die. And my little camp stove, I only had a limited supply of gas, so I would put snow in my water bottle and try to sleep with it, but I was freezing in these storms. So my time was limited there, and when you're there, you don't know how long you're going to be able to stay there and still survive. And then the middle of the night, because I had turned on my headlamp only for a very short time, because in the cold your batteries will die, and I didn't know how long I might need my headlamp or how long I'd be there. So because I turned my headlamp on, my orange dome tent was glowing like this little moon, and all of a sudden it unzipped in the night, and it was a man and his son, and they had tried to pick up salt that the yaks had dumped on the Tibet side and had tried to carry it over to make great trades, and they got stuck in the storm and they probably would have died, but they saw the orange and beeline to it, and they unzipped my tent and they saw how sick I was, and they brewed up something that within a couple of days I was able to get up on my feet and get down to lower ground, which you can heal better at you can't, I mean, it sounds dramatic, but at high altitude, humans can't live above 17,000 feet. You're continually dying. You know, that it sounds dramatic, but that's what's happening. So I was able to go lower to heal, but I also sort of learned and felt that this father-son duo, there were no women at the house, and I think they treated me so well because there were no women in their lives, and I was up there flailing, and they would have frozen. So I'm not sure if you were looking towards that. I mean, again, it made me appreciate women and their role in people's lives. I think they had empathy for me, but also at that time, it switched me over into living just like the locals because I ran out of all kinds of supplies. I was eating tsampa, which is ground barley, with tea, with yak butter, just like the yaks were. Well, they wouldn't put the yak butter in for the yaks, but they would tsampa and tea they would give to the yaks, and that's what the people going over the pass would eat. So I had no clothes but what was on my back. So I basically started living just like they were as traders. You wear the same thing every day. You sleep in it. That's what you eat. There's streams. You can kind of clean yourself up a little bit. And so I kind of dipped right into the rhythms of their life. And they took me in. And I think that's what really turned me towards looking at indigenous people, who they are, how they live. And then I wanted to, I came up with the idea of living with an indigenous tribe on each continent and writing about them and photographing them for the Vanishing Cultures series. So I kind of switched from setting records and proving that could be done to trying to capture as much about the lives of these indigenous people before it was too late, that you couldn't photograph it anymore.
Say a little bit more about what led you to shift from high-altitude adventurer to chronicler of vanishing cultures.
When I set the high-altitude skiing record in far western China, after we were done, I saw some yurts that I could go down valley to, which I did on my own, and there were the Kirkiz women that were there, and they were herding their sheep and goats. And they invited me in, and the men weren't really around. They must have been out farther, going out to get some of the camels or whatever. This is on Marco Polo's route. There really were camels there. The Asiatic camel, not the African camel. They're quite different. It has two humps instead of one. But anyhow, and hanging out with the Kyrgyz women, we traded earrings, we laughed, I rocked the babies, they gave me some of their yogurt, and it was such a totally different vibe. I think if the men had come in to take photos and hang out, they would have been much more reserved. But every woman who's ever, I hadn't had a baby yet at that point, but every woman, which I learned in the future when I did, who's had a baby knows the other woman, you know, and it's even before having babies. So anyhow, they would let me hold their babies and they would point like, do you have one? And I'd say no. And they would laugh at me like, what's wrong with you, girl? And it's just that sense and notion of how we're all the same, that I think I wrote a story for Powder Magazine about that high altitude ski. And a lot of the story was about the Kyrgyz women. And there was a woman named Pat Cochran. She was the first female editor at Powder Magazine, which I don't know if you ever bumped into her. And she saw that and wanted something of the Kyrgyz women put in the article. And so did I, and we got it in there. So that was it wasn't a feminist thing. It was just, we were talking about it, and I did the whole boomba of I set the record, and I go, yeah, but Pat, the really coolest thing was these people. So if you go look at that old article, the Kyrgyz are in there. So when it's only looking back that I realized that was probably the very beginning of really feeling at home with people who are connected to the land and the animals. And I should say I grew up on a dairy farm in Middlebury. 6 of 7 kids. And so every day on the farm, I mean, there's cows. We had chickens and the chicken coop and pigs and dogs and cats. Yeah. So to a certain extent, in my formative years, we moved when I was 12 onto a marina on Lake Dunmore. But my formative years were, you know, running around a farm with lots of different types of animals. So I probably felt deep down much more at home, like with these Kyrgyz women that were herding the sheep and goats. And we just hung out and had the best time. We didn't have to speak the same language at all. And I'm just trying to say, especially if it's foreign and a guy comes in with a big beard, they might have been very taken aback or whatever. But I come in and it's like, hey, girl, what you doing? Get in here. What are you wearing?
They could relate to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you grow up on a farm, on a dairy farm in Middlebury. How do you develop this taste for international adventure from a farm in Addison County?
Where you never leave because you milk the cows 2 times a day.
Yeah.
Curiosity. Just plain curiosity, I think. I went to the University of Vermont, and the first month I was there, I had already applied. This is in the first month of being a freshman at school because I really didn't go anywhere before that.
Yeah.
Well, although I saw Colorado because Nordic skiing was my basketball. It was my way out. So I had already skied in competition in Colorado. So I started to see. Yes, I started to see what big mountains were like. And our coach, John Caldwell, he even apologized to me as an adult. He goes, I remember I took y'all up to Rabbit Ears Pass, which is up high, and, you know, on your rest day just to go get a little exercise, but, you know, not do much. And he goes, that was a mistake. It tired everybody out. And I said, no, you never apologized. That didn't tire me out. I said, that just turned me on for the going for big mountains from then on. I mean, it was just, it was like this light going on. You mean there's mountains like this and you can go up in here? And so we've had a funny conversation. Just this, that happened like maybe 5 years ago. He still even remembered that, John Caldwell in Putney, Vermont.
Yes, who is a legend in the world of absolutely Nordic skiing.
And I said, John, you sent me on my way. But So we digress. What were we talking about?
Well, we were talking about the connection between being a farm girl,
oh, farm girl.
In Vermont
so,
and
so,
a
yeah,
global adventurer.
Already at UVM. So in that first month, I was had applied and been accepted to go to school in Norway. So then the next year, I spent my whole year in Norway. I learned Norwegian. I took all my tests and exams in Norwegian. I joined a rescue squad. We learned how to dig snow holes and pull people out of everywhere. I took an ice climbing course. I would spend my vacation time up on the glaciers. So that was my first year at UVM. I raced. UVM imported all these Norwegian skiers.
And still does.
And I fortunately did well enough to still stay on the UVM ski team, but I loved all the Norwegians, so that was part of, I want to go there to train. They come here, I'm going there.
Yeah.
So it was a switch.
So as you are gaining this, you know, national and international stature as an adventurer, an explorer, and as a woman, as breaking barriers for women, how do other women respond to you in the early years of your accomplishments?
Well, in the early years, how did they respond? Not much. I mean, it wasn't noticed, really. I mean, I did some research to look back on this, and I do see what happened to women in trying to move up in a law office as a lawyer and whatnot. Only on one expedition, there was another woman who didn't go to climb. She was trying to set up an adventure travel company. But I was judged a lot for my behavior. I hate to talk about this because data says if you, in some capacity, if you have 30% females, then the females are very supportive of each other. But what happened in the beginning, when you might be in any kind of business capacity, there's two or three women and only one is going to make it up the ladder, it pits a very small number of women against women. And there would be judgment that I was acting too masculine if I would put on, you know, shorts, you know, running shorts and even back then, it was the birth of the jog bra. You know, it was radical if I would wear some of that stuff out. You know, I should cover up kind of thing. So there's a lot of judgment. There was a lot of judgment between women. And then hopefully I didn't do this, but sometimes the go-for-it women would judge the women being more, I hate to say feminine, because being feminine is totally cool, but more like following the example of how they dressed and the makeup they wore and might not be out there. You know, it was important how they looked as opposed to their performance. So it was a very complicated time, and social scientists sorted that out, that if there's only a very small number of women and only one's going to go up, it's called a tightrope. You were judged for either being too feminine or too masculine in your character. And it was very difficult to figure out just exactly what would move you forward, i.e. in talking about the glass summit. And for me, I just can't get away from being myself. So I just did what felt right and felt like me and just carried on and tried not to judge.
And yet, I couldn't help but notice in your book, you and Ned Gillette were the first sponsored athletes by the North Face.
Yes.
Which is a big deal. You know, now the North Face team is
over,
you know,
80.
Yeah, they're some of the top athletes in every sport. But the photo of you that they chose for their advertisements was one of you crossing a river.
Oh, yeah.
Without pants on, so you're bare-legged. And I was like, really? So this is the image that they choose of the many incredible images of you.
Absolutely.
Climbing,
yep,
mountains. Did it occur to you?
It was already out before I could say anything, and I didn't really fuss much in any of that, but I will admit this is something no one's ever asked me, and I don't know what Hap would say now. Hap's still alive. He's a friend of mine, Hap Klopp.
Was he the North Face team?
Well, he was the North Face. He owned North Face.
Okay.
He bought it from Doug Tompkins, who, well, that's a whole nother story, all the way back to the original sort of dirt bags and climbers. He has all the Patagonia property that he set it aside. That is Doug Tompkins.
Yes, this is in Patagonia in southern South America, in Argentina, right. And Chile.
And Patagonia, the company, was started by Yvon Chouinard, and they, with a couple other people, you know, had done the original Fun Hog expedition.
Right. I don't want to digress into these guys. But you were saying about them using images of you.
Hapklop bought North Face from Doug Tompkins. And Hap and I are sitting down, and I had shown him some designs. We helped design the dome tent. There were pup tents before that. There were no dome tents. This really dates me. There was not an internal frame pack. We helped design that. And Gore-Tex had never been used in products. We used the first Gore-Tex. It was only in the medical industry as products. And that, let's credit Hapklop for that, because he got the designers and they hired us and we worked with them on that. And I'm sitting down with Hap and I showed him some changes in designs and some of the clothing that I would like to have. And I said, you should start designing some clothing and equipment for women. And he just laughed and he goes, there's no market for that. And I said, they're all right behind me, Hap. It's coming. Well, look at Athleta, you know, all these catalogs now. He laughed at me, but then back to the original story. And then he goes, well, we've hired you, and it's good to have a woman because sex sells. Hap literally said that to me. And I'm like,
how did you react to that then?
I just laughed.
And yet you knew there was a subtext of that. And there with their first ad, they're showing you half clothes.
Right, but that's we should explain to the audience, though, the reason you're like that on a river, I understand what you're trying to say, but it is so important to keep all your clothing dry that with your pack and your skis, you strip everything off so that on the other side of the river, when you're frozen, you have warm clothing to put on.
Sure.
And I understand you're saying like, oh, they picked that picture because I'm a woman and you can't see much. You just see a bare leg.
Right.
So it was tasteful. It was a national ad. It also showed this pack over 50 pounds that I'm carrying. So think about some of these other things. A lot of the photos of the guys later on skiing in New Zealand stripped down to their waist were out there as ski ads. So it kind of went both ways back then, which you didn't see. So no, I didn't get alarmed. It did show what actually was happening. It was a real photo. The guys got shown that way. They loved showing, you know, suns out, guns out. I didn't think too much of it at the time, quite frankly.
Yeah. How did fame affect you? It's a complicated thing. You write at one point in your book about just wanting to crawl into your tent at Yosemite and not be the famous climber girl.
Well, I don't think I've ever really been famous, so I'm not sure about climbing into the tent in Yosemite unless it was because someone heard there. It's a small community that when you set records, people have expectations and you just want to do your thing. But I think in terms of fame, and to put what we were just talking about into perspective about why that picture didn't bother me and some of the biggest sort of fame moments, Jane Pauley is interviewing me on national television. Okay, I've set some records. And in the green room, before you go in, you see the questions your questioner is going to ask you so that neither of you look foolish in front of the camera. You know, that you kind of know what's coming, but not exactly. So she felt really comfortable with me because, as you can see, I can talk. So she leaves her script and she goes, so Jan, what do you think of the ERA, which is the Equal Rights Amendment? And I looked at her and I said, so Jane, what's that? And she, you could see this blank look in her eye, and she's a professional, and she said, well, I guess that answers my question. And then she went right back to the script so that with that picture they chose and being interviewed about the Equal Rights Amendment, is those things were so far from my mind in my 20s when I'm working hard and training hard and having a blast and working with North Face and developing products and traveling the world and finding out after the fact that I set a record, that that stuff just didn't mean much to me. It didn't register. There was nothing that I was trying to prove, quite frankly. I was just having fun. As simple, makes me sound like a simpleton, but you know, think of young guys in their 20s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Well, so interestingly, you go from kind of center stage to, you know, the title of the series that has really come to define much of your life, Vanishing Cultures, is exactly that. It's disappearing. These are people who are very far from any spotlights. In fact, we don't even know about some of these cultures, the Yanomami in the Amazon. You have books about the Lion Queens of India, the matrilineal cultures in the Sahara, and most recently the Bahao people in the islands of Southeast Asia. Why did you feel so drawn to these communities?
Because a couple of things. I think they have more to tell us than we have to tell them. And this is even before we had cell phones. And I mean, back when I started Vanishing Cultures, the only thing we had was telex. We didn't even have fax machines. So I think anyone listening who's young, they don't even know what I'm talking about here. And I already envisioned how we were losing a lot of our sense of being human, and I would feel it. I wouldn't just see it, I would feel it when I was with indigenous people. And now we're losing our connection with each other even more. So maybe it helps describe to you that when I just think these are all the fingers and toes of the human family. And I just really wanted to show how much we are so much more alike than we are different. We're a human family. And if people could see it and understand it, we might treat each other differently. And then I was just turning 30. Just before that, I had a back issue. We didn't really know what it was, but I had ruptured a disc. And the surgeon said, sometimes it abates. I waited 2 months. I couldn't walk for 2 months. I had a little desk built so I could do my writing laying down. I'd have to roll off the couch and go on hands and knees to answer the phone. We only had landlines back then.
At age 30.
This was about 29. Yeah. And I eventually, the doctor told me if I got something called foot drop, which means the nerve damage was bad enough that it wouldn't reconstitute, let's say. Your nerves can regenerate. So once I got to that point, I said, okay, I don't want to be tripping over a foot all my life. Let's do the surgery. So they went in and took the pieces out to take them off my spinal cord. And during the 2 months, and then it worked out okay, knock on wood. But during those 2 months, I had a long time to think about, okay, so you've set records, you've done this, you've done that. What if they put you back together, what is it you really want to do? And it was, I thought back to the Kyrgyz. I just said, you know, these people, nobody knows about them. Nobody hears their voice. I can skydive, scuba dive. I can do whatever. I can get anywhere. I am going to go visit an indigenous tribe. I'll start with the Himalaya and the Sahara, because I'd already been in the Atlas Mountains and had snowboarded a peak there.
In Morocco.
Yep, the highest peak there. And I said snowboarded. The first time I did it on tele skis, I went back later and snowboarded it. Snowboards weren't invented yet. So really dating myself here. But I had a friend. I couldn't sit upright yet, but I was healing, and she drove me to New York. She was going to New York, and I remember going in, can't do this anymore. It's publishing's too busy, but I had contacted a couple of editors, and I went to see them in New York because they knew I'd done some National Geographic work. And I remember going in and talking to the one that eventually took the first two books of Vanishing Cultures. And they kept saying, well, why don't you sit down? You know, I'm showing them slides, literally slides and what I want to do. No, just sit down. And oh, no, I've been, you know, in the car all day. I'd rather stand up. I couldn't even sit down. I'm telling these people I'm going to go here and do this and do that. And I couldn't even sit yet.
Wow.
And they did. They gave me the advance. And I went to the Himalaya and the Sahara. Their books were in production. And they liked them enough that they went to the Himalayas there. Then I went to Far North, which is the Samis and Australia Aboriginals, all on $2,500.
Wow. What do you want young women who read your stories to take away from your life story?
Well, I know you heard my lecture at the ski museum, and I really feel like if they just look at any of my work, not just Glass Summit, but any of my kids' books or whatever, I just want to be that voice in their ear that says, you've got this, you can do this, you have all the skills you need to make it happen, and any of the skills you feel you need, you can acquire them. So go. You've got this. That extra voice that supports a woman.
The title of your memoir, The Glass Summit. I'm calling it your memoir. I don't know if you call it that.
No, I'm still living. There's more.
Do you feel like you've shattered the glass summit?
What does it say? I'm looking at my own subtitle here. One woman's breaking through. So yeah, I guess if I broke through, I did. It's right in the subtitle, David.
One woman's epic journey breaking through. Well, that's a good note to end on. So, Jan Reynolds, thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation and sharing your story.
And thanks for your patience with my long stories. So pick up a book and get the rest of the story.
At janreynolds.com.
janreynolds.com.
Thank you.
That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.